Thanks for the kind introduction. I'm very happy and honored to be here. Welcome back, everybody. And so now, having concluded the first half of the lectures, we'll finally get into my narrow area of specialization, semantic typology. And this is going to be the introduction to it. So I'm going to give you the short answer to the question, what is semantic typology? Then we're going to look at linguistic typology in general for some background. I'm going to introduce the method for doing semantic typology that, well, my former colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics tend to call it the Nijmegen method, although people outside the Max Planck Institute take issue with that label, because it's not obvious that the Max Planck Institute can lay claim to being the sole originator of this method, or even historically the first originator. So I mentioned this morning the problem of etic grids, the issue and the problem of etic grids, and that's something we'll need to talk about. And that pretty much sums it up for today. Okay, so for my introduction to the problem of semantic categorization, I like to use a clip that all my students already know, and they get tired because they know what's coming every time I play it, but I can't get tired of it.
Okay.
So our little robot is sorting his prize possessions, and he's coming across a problem. He's trying to classify an implement that Americans call a spork, which is a combination of a spoon and a fork. And he has a category of spoons and he has a category of forks, and this one falls right in between, which is the conclusion that he comes up with eventually. Yeah. Okay. Now, what the heck does that have to do with semantic typology? Nothing in particular, and a lot, depending on how you look at it. What this illustrates more are the basic properties of categorization more generally. We have categories that we try to subsume stuff under. We like to sort it into one bin or another. And what's interesting is we use these categories for thinking about stuff, for identifying it, for identifying the properties, and so on and so forth. But we also use categories when we talk about stuff. So reference to linguistic reference to things in the world, objects, events, actions, states, and what have you, require a classification of these entities or states of affairs, and it requires a classification in terms that are prescribed by the conventions of the language you're using. That's the problem of semantic categorization, and the study of that is basically semantic typology. So here we have the problem of sorting colors into semantic categories, which we've already discussed several times during these lectures. I'm not going to repeat that, but you're familiar with the basic idea. There are languages that have basic color terms for green and blue, such as English. There are languages that have a single basic color term for green and blue, but not other colors, such as Yucatec. And then there are languages that have basic color terms for green, dark blue, and light blue, such as Russian and Turkish, and so on. Semantic typologists study such semantic categorization systems in individual languages, and then they try to describe the distribution of these properties across the languages of the world, as is represented here by this map from the World Atlas of Language Structures, which I already showed you during Monday's lecture, I think, Monday morning maybe, which gives you the distribution of languages that have a single category for yellow and blue, green and blue versus languages that distinguish at the level of basic color terms between green and blue. Once we've mapped out the distribution of semantic categories across the languages of the world, we try to formulate implicational generalizations over them. The best known example is Berlin and Case evolutionary scale over possible basic color term systems, which we discussed this morning. Let me talk a little bit about the history of this enterprise. It really started in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, with studies such as Lewis Henry Morgan's kinship term questionnaire, which we did also talk about this morning. Charles Darwin was actually an early pioneer of semantic typology, believe it or not. He did also a questionnaire study on gestures. Gestures in different languages and cultures. Co-speech gestures and their meanings. We also already talked about Hugo Magnus' study of color terminologies, which was essentially based on a methodology similar to Berlin and Case. He used a smaller stimulus kit, but a larger sample of languages. Now, I also mentioned this morning already that this line of research pretty much went dark in the beginning of the 20th century because much of it was marred by invalid assumptions, racist and social Darwinist ideology, and so on and so forth, but also by a lack of sophisticated methods of linguistic semantic analysis. So that's where, you know, we perhaps have come a little farther in the present, and therefore have picked up the thread once again and resumed the enterprise of semantic typology and, maybe made some progress, maybe. So in between, however, there was a second phase, and that was ethnosemantics and enterprise primarily seeded in cultural and linguistic anthropology, and that's what we talked about this morning. So that was research that did look at semantic categorization, but not so much from a typological perspective, but rather primarily primarily in terms of studies that would look at one language and one culture only. But this research program was very much informed by the linguistic relativity hypothesis, by attempts at confirming or disconfirming the linguistic relativity hypothesis, or by attempts at doing what Worf actually suggested to the scientific community should be done, which is not to test the linguistic relativity hypothesis, because he never thought about a linguistic relativity hypothesis. The research program that he suggested was one of studying cultures in the terms prescribed, made available, if you will, by the native language of the speakers, of the members of the culture. In other words, what Worf called the linguistic relativity principle was really all about describing cultures in their own terms. Something quite different from how it came to be interpreted later. Alright, so then the third and contemporary phase is the resurgence of semantic typology, which is actually part and parcel of the resurgence of typology in general. Typology, linguistic typology, syntactic phonological typology has seen a history similar to that of semantic typology. It was originally a 19th century enterprise, then it pretty much became dormant, or as people no doubt thought at the time, extinct, until it was revived by Joseph Greenberg in the early 1960s. In the 1980s, there were a number of large-scale studies on semantic categorization across languages, which, however, used primarily questionnaire data. Well, Dahl's study on tense mood aspect systems used questionnaire data. We actually talked about Dahl's questionnaire yesterday, whereas Arke Wieberg's classic study on perception verbs, the semantics of perception verbs across languages, and of course Talmy's lexicalization patterns and motion descriptions. These two were not primarily based on original data collected by the researchers, but rather on secondary sources, on available descriptions of the relevant languages. Okay, so here's a list of some recent studies, some of which we'll still discuss as we go along, such as the one by Patterson and colleagues on spatial frames of reference and spatial categorization in 13 languages. In 2003, Steve Levinson and Serge Meira, and the LNC group, of which I was a member then, did a study on the semantic similarity of topological spatial relations across different languages, focusing specifically on adpositions, prepositions, and postpositions, on the basis of data collected with the BowPad picture series, which has come up already various times in the lectures. And more recently, Ketapal et al. Did another study using a different style of analysis of the same set of data. I did a project with two colleagues in 2006 on motion event categorization based on Lantami's typology, and here the question was to what extent does this influence the non-linguistic categorization of motion events. We looked back then at a sample of 17 languages, but we're still working on this. And we're actually testing speakers of additional languages as we speak now. I also already mentioned the study on verbs of cutting and breaking that we did at the Max Planck Institute in the beginning of the last decade. So I did a paper on the argument structure of verbs of cutting and breaking based on data from 17 languages. Again, this is coincidence. It's not the same 17 languages. Meanwhile, Asfar Majid and Melissa Bauerman and Jim Boster did a paper on the basis of the same sample, the same data set, but from a larger number of languages, a study on the semantics of verbs of cutting and breaking. Terry Regier and colleagues did an analysis, and I did mention this morning briefly, of the semantic similarity of color terms in the languages of the World Color Survey. So there is a lot of ongoing research. It's a very active field right now, and you can see a trend. The corpora, the sample of languages, the samples of languages that we're working with slowly get larger, and there is a drift towards statistical methods. Slowly but surely, statistics is taking over, quantitative methods are taking over, which is the reason why we'll be talking about quantitative methods in the second lecture tomorrow. Okay, as a quick reminder, by way of background, these are the background assumptions that have been influencing this research project from the get-go. Before the cognitive turn in, the 1940s and 50s, it was widely assumed by linguists and anthropologists and psychologists that a large part of thinking proceeds in terms that are modeled after the semantic categories of the native language, and these categories in turn would be culture specific. Then came the cognitive turn, which put cognition as a pre-structured phenomenon, something that has some sort of information that the child is born with from the get-go, that's not a blank slate. That has led over time to a very strong emphasis on innateness, which assumes that large parts of cognition are governed by innate processes and principles, and language and culture really only play a fairly shallow and superficial role in cognition. And finally, you have the Neo-Wolfian program starting somewhere in the late 1980s, probably, with an attempt at putting culture back into its rightful place in the theory of cognition. At least, from my point of view, that's basically the name of the game. That's what we're trying to do. All right. Now, that's semantic typology in a nutshell. In order to get a better understanding of how this works, how we're getting the data that we need and how we'll analyze them, we have to understand a little more about linguistic typology in general. So let me talk a little bit about that. What is typology? Typology is the inductive or bottom-up approach to language universals. That's one way of putting it. You don't have to have the aim of finding language universals when you're doing linguistic typology, but what matters is you're going to come up with generalizations over the distribution of properties across the languages of the world, and these generalizations are therefore valid for the total number of extant languages, and in that sense you could say they are universals, although as I mentioned on Monday, they're typically not absolute, exceptionless universals, universals along the lines of all languages have X or Y or Z, right? You will often find statements such as all languages have nouns and verbs, all languages have syllables, all languages have consonants and vowels and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is you can almost always find exceptions to these kinds of claims. Instead, they will be generalizations of the form, if a language has property X, then it also has language property, then it also has property Y, such as we've seen this morning, we saw this morning with respect to the example of Berlin and Case evolutionary scale. All right, so how do you do this? You start out surveying the variation in some domain that you're interested in, which could be a syntactic or morphological domain, or a domain of phonological research, or a semantic one. Any property of language counts. In fact, the British sociolinguist Peter Trudgill just published a very interesting book called Sociolinguistic Typology. Although I think the title is a little bit misleading, because he's not so much talking about a typology of sociolinguistic, the distribution of sociolinguistic types of languages. He's rather talking about sociolinguistic conditions that favor or inhibit language change. Nevertheless, very interesting book. So pick a domain, start out from an initial survey of the variation, try to come up with a list of the discrete types of the phenomenon, of the phenomena for this domain. From there, try to extrapolate a finite list of the possible types, and then try to explain why possible types that don't occur, and why a given particular language has the type it does rather than another type. And this is generally going to lead you to implicational universals, implicational generalizations. And the paradigm for this type of research was Greenberg's classic study of word order universals. I hope I'm not boring you guys to death with this stuff, since I'm sure that people are very familiar with this. But it's important to understand that this was a radical break with the tradition in linguistic typology, the 19th century tradition, which did not ask these kinds of questions, like, you know, what types of word orders occur in the languages of the world, and how can we formulate useful generalizations about the word order phenomena that occur in the languages of the world. Rather, 19th century typology was primarily interested in classifying entire languages and trying to explain why languages look the way they do with respect to assumptions about the culture of the speakers. Along the lines of, whenever a phenomenon looked simpler than a phenomenon in another language, that was assumed to reflect a more primitive culture or something like that. All right. Greenberg's typology of word order universals, very quickly. So assume a typology of the order of the main constituents in transitive clauses, and assume that it's possible to somehow identify the arguments of the transitive verb as a subject and an object. However you do that, which, you know, is really not very clear, because it's not very clear that all languages have subjects and objects, on purely semantic grounds, so maybe we should call the subject an agent or an actor and the object a patient or an undergoer or something like that. But on some such grounds, let's say we can identify the syntactic arguments of the transitive verb. So then among languages that have a single preferred order, we can come up with six logically possible types: SOV, SVO, OSV, OVS, VSO, and VOS. And aside from this, there are languages that have multiple types. There are also languages, for example, my own native language, German, has one type in main clauses and another type in subordinate clauses. There are also languages whose word order is so free that it's impossible to establish a type like this. If you're looking at, if you look at the distribution of these types across the languages of the world, you find that two types, namely SOV and SVO, are extremely frequent. SOV, of course, being the type of, for example, Turkish and Japanese, and SVO that of Mandarin and English. And then a much less frequent type is verb initial and has the subject either preceding the object, as in Welsh or the Mayan language Hakaltek, or even less frequently a language that has the verb in initial position and the subject in final position. That happens to be the case in Yucatec, the language I work on, but also, for example, in Malagasy. And then object initial languages are really exotic. And the type that has the object in initial position and the verb in final position is apparently still unattested. And so once you've established these types, you can start formulating implicational generalizations. So for example, Greenberg proposed that whether a language has prepositions or postpositions correlates with whether the language puts the object before or after the verb. So verb object languages tend to have prepositions, whereas object verb languages tend to have postpositions. And of course, when I say tend to have, you get the sense that I'm talking about quantitative generalizations and that you can use statistical methods to test these, which in turn entails that you're going to benefit from having large corpora of languages that you can look at, large samples of languages that you can look at. Similarly, verb object languages tend to put the possessor after the head in nominal possessive constructions. So they tend to say something like the ball of Peter, whereas object verb languages tend to have the opposite order, so they tend to say something like Peter's ball. And of course then there are a ton of languages that, like English, have both orders. And Greenberg also proposed that whether a language has attributive adjectives preceding or following the nominal head correlates with whether they put the object before or after the verb. So more recently, my colleague Matthew Dreyer compiled a very large database which now has over 1,000 entries, meaning it has information for over 1,000 languages. In this database, which he compiled from existing language descriptions, something in that respect, the syntactic and phonological typologists typically have an edge over the semantic typologists because they can rely on existing language descriptions in a way that the semantic typologists typically cannot, because available descriptions, grammars and dictionaries of the languages of the world typically don't give you much information about the semantics of these languages. But so Matthew compiled a database and against this database tested, did a statistical test of Greenberg's proposed universals and confirm most of them, but disconfirm this one. So the order of the attributive adjective with respect to the noun head does not actually statistically correlate, not significantly anyways, with verb object versus object verb order. Okay, so then once you've found a set of generalizations, you can try to explain these generalizations. And a number of explanations have been proposed. One often finds informal explanations in terms of grammaticalization in the literature. More formal statements include Mark Baker's head directionality parameter. As the name parameter already suggests, this is basically within mainstream generative grammar. Dreyer himself developed what he calls branching direction theory, which basically says a language tends to be consistently left branching or right branching, and that in turn can be explained in terms of processing. So the idea is that if a language has consistent left branching or consistent right branching, that might ease processing relative to a language in which either order occurs with roughly even frequency. And then people have tried to formulate the generalizations in optimality theory, and most recently an article by Michael Dunn and colleagues appeared in the journal Nature last year, in which they tried to show that word order patterns actually vary much more across language families than they do within language families, which they attribute to extant word order patterns basically being properties of linguistic lineages rather than being governed by universal principles, be it principles of universal grammar, as Mark Baker claims, or be it universal principles of cognition, as Matthew Dreyer and Jack Hawkins have claimed. And this triggered a huge uproar in the field of typology. There was a special issue of the Journal of Linguistic Typology dedicated to this controversy, which basically had a lot of people come up and pointing out weaknesses with Dunn et al.'s weaknesses in Dunn et al.'s statistical analysis, but above all pointed out that actually the message they are making here, the point they are making has two aspects to it. One is that genealogical relationships and also language contact are much stronger factors than whatever universal cognitive tendencies such as processing pressures might have an influence on word order. But that is something that typologists have always taken for granted. That is something that has long been known. It has long been known that word order patterns tend to be more consistent within language families, and therefore presumably languages to some extent inherit them from their ancestors. That does not, however, mean, and that's done at a second point, and that's where they're going too far, that there are no universal tendencies. However weak they are, they exist. They are manifest even in Dunn et al.'s data, and as a result, they still call for an explanation. And the cognitive explanation, the explanation in terms of processing pressures proposed by Dreyer and Hawkins, continues to be valid. At least it's not challenged by, I mean, you know, once you've taken into account the balance of evidence, it's not challenged by the data presented by Dunn and colleagues. Okay, so I mentioned the database that Matthew Dreyer compiled when Matthew Dreyer and Joan Bybee are pretty much the pioneers of doing statistics on large samples of languages starting in the 1980s, and the database that Dreyer compiled for his study of word order universals, word order patterns in the languages of the world, was kind of the has become the core of what's now the World Atlas of Language Structure, which is a project that hundreds of linguists from all over the world have contributed to. There's a published hardcover version, but there's also an online version which you can consult for free. There's a list of currently around 140 features, some syntactic, most syntactic, some phonological, some in fact semantic, such as the distinction of color term systems that we looked at before, which you can click on, and it will give you a map of the distribution of these features across the languages of the world. And moreover, you can combine multiple features, and the search interface will give you an output that shows how the distribution of one feature correlates with that of another feature. All right. So let's turn to the so-called Nijmegen method. And I have to say, I probably should stop using this term because I've gotten so much flack for using it. I mean, I'm not the one who introduced it. Steve Levinson introduced it. But the problem is, once you understand what the method is in a nutshell, if anything, it ought to be called the Berkeley method, because it's really basically the blueprint for this so-called Nijmegen method was really Berlin and case study. All right. So the core elements of the Nijmegen method are the etic grid, the set of nonverbal stimuli, the coding of, I mean, the collection, the gathering of descriptions of the stimuli from speakers of a large, as large as possible, range of independent languages. And when I say independent, what I mean by that is unrelated, not in contact with one another, and if possible, also from different areas. So we're trying to get the best spread possible, and once you get the data, you're going to perform a semantic analysis and a distributional analysis, trying to uncover underlying implicational generalizations along the lines of Greenberg's paradigm. All right, so let's do this in a little bit more detail. So you start from the etic grid, but actually you start with constructing the etic grid itself. And so the etic grid is a term that has come up several times already. Let me at least now finally tell you why it's called the etic grid. It comes from phonetic, which is odd, right? Why would a research tool for semantic typology come from phonetic? Well, that's why we got rid of the phone part. Okay, so what the heck am I talking about? The idea of an etic grid was originally modeled after something like the the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is a phonetic classification of the possible speech sounds that occur in the languages of the world in terms of their articulatory and acoustic properties. So this is a phonetic classification, therefore it's not a language-specific classification. It does not take into account the function that the sound plays in the particular language, whether it's a phoneme, a meaning distinguishing element in that particular language, or whether it's only an allophone of some other sound category. So that means phonetic categories are not language-specific, whereas phonemic or phonological categories are language-specific. So Pike, who introduced this distinction, took this opposition between phonetic and phonemic categories, where the phonetic categories are non-language specific and the phonemic categories are language specific, and he generalized it to any kind of contrast between a language or culture independent classification and a linguistic or culture specific, language or culture specific classification. So an attic grid is a categorization that is language independent. And it's supposed to hold as a classification matrix, or for the domain of study, a classification matrix that is valid for all languages and therefore can be used as a frame of reference to map the different category boundaries in the different languages that you're going to study. And it's been alleged, well, not just alleged, but people have pointed out that this is a dangerous method. This is a very problematic approach in the sense that it always introduces a bias, necessarily introduces a bias, and possibly even the risk of circularity, and that is true. And we'll talk about that after our break, which is coming up shortly. It introduces the risk of circularity, which some people have claimed renders studies of this type, studies that use this methodology, invalid. But they haven't proposed an alternative. So in effect, what these people are saying, and when I say these people, I mean, for example, John Lucy, who is actually somebody who has been generally highly sympathetic to the research of the Nijmegen group, Steve Levinson's group. Based on his criticism of attic grids, you have to conclude that he assumes that semantic typology, to the extent that it's based on this method, is itself invalid. So instead of going out and studying a large sample of languages typologically in this manner, we should probably just resort to study individual languages only. So I don't agree with that, obviously. But I'll tell you what I think about the attic grid controversy and how to deal with attic grids after the break. So we've seen a bunch of examples of attic grids over the time. In Berlin and Case study, the attic grid was the Mansur-Kala chart. That's probably the most famous attic grid in any study of this type. In the classic work on kinship terminologies, starting with Lewis Henry Morgan, the attic grid is the genealogical network of relationships in the research on ethnobiology by Berlin and colleagues. It's the Linnaean classification, a scientific classification of plants and animals. And so on and so forth. So the Eddie grid, of course, doesn't come out of the blue. When you're starting on a project of semantic typology, there's always already some literature that's there, at least maybe descriptions that are based on languages from one day, on data from one language only. So those descriptions you can go by when constructing the Attic grid. But once you've arrived at an Attic grid, which is basically your prediction of what the independent conceptual dimensions of the domain of study are going to be like, meaning the conceptual dimensions along which the categories of individual languages and categories across languages might contrast. Once you've predicted these dimensions, once you've constructed your Attic grid, you then proceed to devise sets of predominantly nonverbal stimuli that encode the various cells of this grid exhaustively. It doesn't have to be a set of non-linguistic stimuli. You can also construct a questionnaire, which is a linguistic approach, which is, for example, what Ersten Dahl and colleagues did for that study. That was also based on an Attic grid, although they didn't make that Attic grid very explicit. But in the particular, in Berlin and case study, obviously, the cells were encoded as color chips. In other words, non-verbally, for very obvious reasons, because it's very difficult to do a questionnaire study on color terminology. And that's been the predominant approach in the Nijmegen tradition as well, and it's been the predominant approach in my own work. You then proceed to collect descriptions of these stimuli under a particular protocol, which has to be fixed. So, you know, remember yesterday we talked about the problem of giving the participants a specific task of what they're supposed to be doing with nonverbal stimuli. Remember the example of the Baupert pictures. The speakers are supposed to locate one object with respect to another, but in order to do that in the sense that is intended by the design of the study, you have to give them an elaborate context in which they do this. So you have to be very careful of about how you formulate the task. With that protocol, which has to be realized in the same way by every collaborating researcher with every population that is tested, you then go out and collect data from a range of languages as varied as possible. I already mentioned it's supposed to be genealogically independent in terms of contact, as widely distributed geographically as possible, and I should say they're also supposed to be typologically independent in the sense of if you assume a classification of the languages of the world in terms of basic typological parameters such as word order or or the typology of head marking versus dependent languages, etc., etc. You want languages that are as different from one another as possible, so as to ensure that your findings aren't an artifact of some other of some linguistic type, and really are valid only for that particular linguistic type rather than for all languages of the world. And of course, I already explained you have to do this collaboratively, because it's not going to be possible for any decent-sized sample of languages that you alone can collect all the data. You may be able to collect the data, but you won't be able to analyze it, since you won't be able to have the kind of expert knowledge of all of these languages that's needed to perform any, however modest, level of semantic analysis in them. And so this need to go collaborative, to have a team of researchers that collect the data, has been limiting the size of the language samples, which has been lagging far behind that which is now the standard in syntactic typology. But as we already talked about, the main reason for this difference really is the availability of existing descriptions for the kind of data that you can do syntactic typology on, but not for the kind of data that semantic typologists want to work with, are interested in. In reality, the largest study in semantic typology ever carried out was not actually the World Color Survey, which looked at 110 languages, but the Mesoamerican Color Term Survey, which was conducted by Robert McLaury and collaborators in the 1990s, which looked at something along the lines of between 130 and 140 languages of a particular geographic area, actually. From there, the number goes rapidly down. In the Nijmegen paradigm, the largest study that we've done was, in fact, the study of verbs on cutting and breaking. So data for that project has been collected from around 30 different languages spoken all over the world. Now, 30, by the standards of the kind of sample that's now pretty much the norm in syntactic typology, which, you know, that starts anywhere above maybe 200 languages. So that's a pathetic number, that's very, very small. But it's the best we can do at the moment in semantic typology. These are issues that we still need to talk about that I will talk about a little bit tomorrow. You have to ideally take into account the possibility of not only inter-speaker variation, meaning variation across different speakers of the same language, but also intra-speaker variation. Which means one and the same speaker may give you a range of different responses. People have been using different approaches to this problem, very popular one is to just simply go with the first response. I'm not actually a huge fan of that. I think it's important to get the range of possible responses, and within this range identify the speaker's preferred response. But that, of course, takes a lot more time and effort. There is always the possibility of elicitation artifacts. There is always the possibility of limited ecological validity, meaning you're collecting the data on the basis of a task and or a set of stimuli that really have no place in the everyday culture of the people you're working with, and therefore could be argued to really not represent the cognitive and linguistic practices of this community very well, meaning the results won't reflect the cognitive preferences and practices of the community. The way to guard against these kinds of effects is to check the data that you've collected on the basis of your stimulus set that in turn is based on the ethic grid against other sources of data, and in particular less controlled sources of data. So to make this a little bit more concrete, let's say you're doing a study on spatial frames of reference, which is something that I've been working on for quite a while and intensively so recently. Then, aside from controlled elicitation procedures, you also want to look at, for example, local history narratives, descriptions of the, well, local environment or something like that, which are going to produce a lot of situated spatial references, and you want to see what kinds of frames of reference people use for that kind of stuff. Alright. Am I going out of focus or is it the projector? Funny. Okay. So you then try to perform an analysis, semantic and pragmatic analyses of the collected extensional data in order to try to get at the underlying senses. That's what we were talking about yesterday. You want to use statistical techniques to analyze correlations. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow a little bit. Formulate implicational generalizations, try to come up with possible cognitive motivations or cultural motivations for these generalizations. Okay, so why do we do this? I already mentioned the principal goals of this line of research on Monday. One goal is to try to demarcate the boundary between biology and culture in cognition, meaning identify the role culture and biology, meaning the genes, our genetic heritage, play in human cognition, and how these two, figure out how these two interact. You're in the process going to be able to verify or reject innateness claims, which used to be incredibly pervasive, and in some corners of the cognitive sciences still are, but they are being beaten back now under what I've been referring to as the cognitive, I mean the empiricist turn in the cognitive sciences. Meanwhile, you're also going to be able to shed more light on not just the role language plays in cognition and vice versa, the role cognition plays in language, but also on the principles that govern the meaning of linguistic, I mean the mapping of linguistic, between linguistic form and meaning at the syntax-semantics interface. Starting, of course, from principles of lexicalization, what principles govern, what conceptual categories, which conceptual categories get expressed across languages, but ranging all the way to the syntactic side of the syntax-semantics interface, such as principles of argument structure, such as in the study on the argument structure of verbs of cutting and breaking, which I alluded to, or for that matter, principles of event segmentation, which we'll talk about on Friday. All right. And there is a number of other sources of evidence concerning the nature and workings of the interface between language and non-linguistic cognition, and ultimately it's always going to be very, very fruitful to try to combine the research, the results from semantic typology with these other sources of evidence, in particular evidence from language acquisition research and developmental psychology, evidence from sign language research, co-speech gesture, and of course language processing research. Those are the principal sources that we can draw on when we're trying to find out what cognitive processes are involved when people speak or prepare to speak or when they comprehend speech. All right, so let's talk about the knotty issue of etiquettes. So I already mentioned the International Phonetic Alphabet as a sort of model of etiquettes. Of course, this is not a model of a semantic etiquette. It's an etiquette for sound categories, but it is an etiquette nonetheless because it's a language-independent classification. In this case, this is the vowel chart. So this is a language-independent classification of vowel-like speech sounds that occur in the languages of the world, based simply on articulatory properties. Doesn't talk about the role that a particular vowel may play in the phonology of any given individual language. That's an emic question. Okay, so we already went over these examples. Some more in the more recent research on taste terms, linguistic categories for tastes. Researchers have used a stimulus kit that is based on the traditional four taste senses of European culture: sweet, salty, what are they? I mean, sweet, salty, and only those two occur to me. What are the other two? That's really weird. Bitter and... So people, I hear people saying spicy, that's actually not a European category. It's often been argued that other languages do have that as a basic category, but it's not in a basic category in European languages.
Sour.
Sour, thank you. I'm getting tired, sorry. Plus a fifth one, which is umami, the category that's associated with monosodium glutamate. And researchers have used samples of foods or chemical substances that are supposed to induce just these sensations and have studied their classification across languages. In the research on spatial frames of reference, the ATIC grid used to be a three-way classification that was developed by Steve Levinson in the 1990s, which we'll talk about tomorrow. And my collaborators and I have been trying to replace this with a more fine-grained classification, so a different ATIC grid. So I've been referring to ATIC grids themselves as frames of reference, and what I mean by that is illustrated by the Munsell color chart, which you can use as the backdrop for locating the various language-specific color terms in terms of their extensions, which you can represent as Venn diagrams against the grid of the Munsell color chart. Or if you think of Bauerman and Patterson's topological relations picture series, we saw those Venn diagrams that represent the cuts different languages make against some assemblage of the Baupert pictures. You can think of that as an ATIC grid, although that's not the ATIC grid that was originally underlying the study. Now, as I said, people have criticized the approach to semantic typology on the basis of ATIC grids, charging that the use of ATIC grids will bias the findings of your typological study and possibly make the generalizations circular. So this is what we need to take a closer look at. So, in the study of kinship terminologies, it has been charged that the network of genealogical relations that's been used as the ATIC grid since all the way back to the days of Lewis Henry Morgan has been covertly based on assumptions of biological classification in kinship, and these assumptions are not universally valid for all languages. And researchers have argued that we should do away with this methodology, but the problem is, if you get rid of this grid, then how are you going to compare the meanings of different kinship categories across languages? The problem is, for any kind of comparison, you need a tertium comparationis, as it's called in Latin. You need a standard of comparison. You need some kind of frame of reference or map or whatever your preferred metaphor is, some kind of conceptual space such that you can show how the content of the semantic categories of different languages relate to one another. That's the problem. So in the research on color terminologies, John Lucy and others, Saunders and Van Brakel, have charged that the research, the findings that Berlin and Kay proposed in 1969, and that this considerable modifications are still being upheld by the proponents nowadays, are essentially circular in the sense that supposedly one finding of Berlin and Kay's study was that all languages have basic color terms, and basic color terms are lexicalizations of the kind of distinctions that are captured in the Munsell color chart. In other words, they are categories that are based on hue and brightness, and that essentially means that in this approach you're starting out assuming that a classification that is valid for English is applicable to other languages, and then you discover that other languages indeed have a classification system that's like that of English. So this is a quote from John Lucy. He says, "What about the success of the Berlin and Kay approach? After all, as apologists of this tradition often note, it works. These color systems are there. Surely that's an interesting and important fact in its own right. Well, I agree that something is there, but exactly what? I would argue that what is there is a view of the world languages through the lens of our own category, namely a systematic sorting of each language's vocabulary by reference to how and how well it matches of our own." In other words, what Lucy is saying is the Munsell color chart is really an expression of how color is categorized in languages like English, and when we use that as an etiquette, basically we're asking the question of how well other languages conform to these Anglo-centric or Eurocentric categorizations. There are some problems with this criticism. In many ways, it's overblown. For example, there are some claims that Berlin and Kay actually never made. So some of it is based on a misunderstanding of their claims. To some extent, it's also true that Berlin and Kay's claims overshot their own empirical basis. What, in other words, the data they found actually supports. And they had to cut back on these claims considerably, but at heart, the charge that the use of I'm having a problem with these slides because they're animated, but I can't get the animation out because I can't read Chinese. So if I try to edit the slides now, I have to deal with the Chinese menu in PowerPoint, which I can't make sense of. So we'll have to live with this. Yes. So the at the heart of it, the problem that where the charge succeeds is in the claim that the use of etiquettes invariably biases your study, the possible outcomes of your study, and biases in terms that are informed by the distinctions that you put in the etiquette when you construe it. And if you do that on the basis of data from a particular language, then that means the categories of that particular language that you start from are going to bias the outcomes of your study. So that is absolutely true. Lucy and Saunders and Van Brakel are absolutely correct about this point. So specifically, when you are collecting data with stimuli that are based on a particular etic grid, then you will not be able, with this approach, to find any properties of the language-specific categorization of these items that is not captured by the dimensions that already fall into your etic grid. So, in the case of the Berlin and K, in the case of the design of Berlin and K study, if there are language-specific categories that have dimensions other than those of hue and brightness, then those dimensions are not going to show up in your responses. If you use the etic grid to map your responses, if you use the etic grid as a frame of reference to compare the responses that you get from speakers of different languages, the effect of conceptual dimensions not represented in the etic grid is not going to show up. So what about that? It means that you should never confuse the result that you're obtaining with a stimulus kit on the basis of a particular etic grid with the categories of the language itself. What you're getting as a result of such a study, such as Berlin and Kay's study of basic color terms, is a projection. You're getting a projection of the categories of the languages that you're looking at onto the etic grid. At the same time, it's important to understand that this kind of projection can be identified for what it is. So it's not a trap. And a good example of that is the claim from Berlin and Kay's study that all languages have basic color terms, meaning terms that fulfill all those criteria that Berlin and Kay defined as a threshold for identifying basic color terms. They got to be autochthonous, monomorphemic, general currency, and so on and so forth, and obviously have to partition some area of the Mansell color space. So this is, in fact, a claim that was not sufficiently supported by Berlin and Kay's own data, so they overshot on that one. And that was demonstrated in that classic study by Steve Levinson on the language of Russell Island off the coast of Papua New Guinea that I already mentioned earlier. But Levinson demonstrated this on the basis of Berlin and Kay's own methodology, using the very same approach, the color chips, the same technique of identifying basic color terms and looking for their by Berlin and Kay's criteria and looking for their extensions on the Mansell color chart. And the result of this study was that this language doesn't have basic color terms. And Levinson was able to demonstrate this in terms that Berlin and Kay, or Paul Kay, who is the one who's still pursuing this research on color terms actively today, accepted this outcome and modified the claim, and it's now no longer part of the generalizations they propose that all languages have basic color terms. Okay, so I would like to propose some principles, some guiding maxims for working with ethic grids. The first is, when you design the ethic grid, you should take into account evidence from as large and as varied a set of languages as you can possibly get your hands on. So you should be careful not to just look at English or Mandarin or what have you, one language, and think based on the data from that one language, you get an idea of what might be interesting dimensions, interesting potential dimensions, good candidates of dimensions of cross-linguistic contrasts, and design your ethic grid, your possibility space on that basis. You should take into account what is reported in the literature, kinds of variations, phenomena that might drive category distinctions in particular languages. You should take all that information into account when you're designing your ethic grid. I already mentioned this, never confuse the projection of a term's meaning on the ethic grid with the meaning of the term itself. So you're going to be able to see maybe a term showing up somewhere here, so that may look like it's yellow, so you might want to you might be tempted to claim that the term is synonymous with English yellow, but in fact this term might have meaning components that English yellow does not have, and vice versa. So be mindful of the fact that as long as you're talking just on the basis of data collected with the ethic grid, you're not actually talking about the meaning of the terms themselves, you're talking about projections of these meanings. And then, of course, check the ecological validity of the data against data from other sources of evidence, and in particular from less controlled sources of evidence. Ideally, from the observation of spontaneously occurring speech events, or from evidence gained from participant observation. And whenever you encounter evidence of aspects of the grid that aren't cross-linguistically valid, well, you should ideally revise the grid and start over, which, of course, is often a hard thing to do, especially if you've already established a long-standing research tradition on the basis of what you started out with, as in the case of Burnham and Kay. But it's the right thing to do. All right. Quick summary. Semantic typology is the study of universals and cross-linguistic variation in semantic categorization. Semantic categorization is the categorization of extra-linguistic reality in or through the meanings of linguistic expressions. Linguistic typology is the classification of the properties of language on the basis of their distribution across the languages of the world. Ethic grids are ideally language-independent conceptual classifications of stimuli in a given domain. By the way, why am I saying ideally language-independent? Because, of course, it turns out once in a while that your ethic grid, even the International Phonetic Alphabet, it turns out once in a while that it does not properly take into account a kind of distinction that occurs in particular languages, and then it needs to be revised. And ethic grids are used as frames of reference to analyze language-specific categorization. The Nijmegen method, even if that's a misleading term, is an approach to semantic typology based on the constructions of eddic grids, the encoding of the cells of those grids, and sets of nonverbal stimuli. Don't have to be nonverbal, but typically are. The collection of linguistic representations of these stimuli from speakers of a typologically broadly varied and genealogically and aerially independent sample of languages. The semantic analysis of the data and the formulation of implicational generalizations over the results. And that's it. And now we have some time for questions.